In our next and final segment, we're discussing the Department of Justice crackdown on safe injection facilities.
Today in the studio, we have Keith Brown. Keith is the Director of Health and Harm Reduction at the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice, and we're talking to him today about the overdose crisis in America, how states and cities are responding, and how the federal government has recently decided to stand in the way.
Welcome back to the studios, Keith.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Well, hey, thanks for stopping by. Last time you were here, you talked about the overdose crisis in the Capital Region and efforts that your organization has undertaken to address it. Can you speak a little bit about the magnitude of this crisis?
Sure. Well, last time I was in, we talked about the fact that CDC numbers showed that about 64,000 people were dying every year of drug-related deaths and overdose. Just since I was in last time, they released figures for 2017, and it's up to 72,000 people. So,
wow.
The magnitude of this crisis is such that it's shocking. It's painful. People are grief stricken, and right here in the Capital District, we just saw a spike in overdoses over the last week or two. A few of them were fatal. So, this is hitting all communities. The public narrative on this sometimes is that this is a white suburban issue, but we know that drug-related death and overdoses have been impacting black and brown communities for decades. Those communities have been disproportionately harmed by criminalization and the war on drugs and mass incarceration. And just this last year, stats show that drug-related deaths amongst people of color are actually the fastest rising segment of the population. So we've got a real problem that we need to tackle.
Wow. So what factors contribute to the overdose crisis?
Well, I mean, primarily the factor is that we're dealing with this as a criminal justice issue and not as a public health one. So, when you see the
good point.
Yeah, when you see the governmental response around this stuff, sure, some money has been thrown into treatment and some recovery resources, but the things that we really need, which are things that keep people alive and safe so that they can get better. One of the things we know is a lot of people are dying before they even get to treatment. So it's wonderful, and we want all the resources possible to go into treatment and recovery, but the fact is people are dying before they even get there. And so so we need things like harm reduction resources, like syringe exchange and overdose prevention, and we need naloxone in every person's car and every person's pocketbook and purse and every person's home. And we need to address the issue of public nuisance around safer consumption. So we'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay. I understand the California legislature just a few days ago approved legislation that would allow the state to begin opening safe consumption spaces, and the bill is currently on the governor's desk. The last time you were here, you addressed the question of whether the Capital Region was ready for safe consumption spaces. Can you remind our listeners what these spaces are?
Sure. These spaces are public health interventions where people can consume drugs that they've procured elsewhere on site with medical and other personnel present. So what they do is they take drug use out of the sphere of public nuisance, right? So places where we don't want people using drugs is in the park and in playgrounds and in public restrooms and in front of your apartment or your house, right? So
there goes my property value.
Exactly, right? So this takes those activities out of those arenas and into a facility or a room in many cases where folks can consume those substances with medical professionals on hand in case that person overdoses or has another type of adverse reaction. And crucial to our overall public health interventions here is that there's resources for people to get into treatment. So when we think about what an all pathways approach looks like into helping people get better, safer consumption spaces are an incredible tool for people who are usually out there using on their own. They're not engaging in services. They're marginalized. They're criminalized. So it drives those activities farther from care. And so what these facilities do is bring people closer. And, on another level, it treats people with dignity and respect like human beings. You can't really quantify what that means to somebody who is walking around maybe feeling pretty down and pretty desperate all the time. And so having people that care about them show them that they're worthy of love and care and help to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Really important.
Right. What kind of work has been done to get these kind of spaces up and running in the Capital Region?
So we're at the very beginning stages of a public education campaign. I mean, that's really what this is about. And so there's a lot of misconceptions out there about what these facilities are. The media and elected officials are certainly not helping when they talk about these sites. They talk about them as shooting galleries or crack houses or things like that. And I got to tell you, having visited spaces like this myself, it couldn't be farther from what they are actually like. So one of the things we'd like to do is we'd like to demystify this a little bit for the public. We'd like to talk about what these spaces look like, have people realize that they're not scary. When you go to the neighborhoods, I was at a drug consumption room in a larger facility in Amsterdam, and I got to tell you, the community, the neighborhood, they really embrace these facilities because... same thing with law enforcement. So if somebody, for example, is about to use drugs or is using drugs in their park, the police, a neighbor, somebody will say, hey, listen, there's a space you can go to use this stuff. So you're not in the park. It's down the street or here. Let me show you where it is. We really want people to understand that. While the fear mongering around these spaces is that you're going to have people using drugs all around them and you're going to be having people gravitate towards these spaces, they actually address the exact issues that people are saying that they will cause, which is public nuisance, property value stuff, right? Like all of those things. Mm-hmm. So I think really what where we're at right now is we want people to learn about them. We want people to understand why they're important. Just real quick, we hear from parents who've lost kids to overdose. And in that grief, they say, you know, if my kid had a space like this, maybe they'd still be alive. That's really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. That thing of just treating people like humans seems like such an important mental shift. But kind of thinking about that fear mongering, Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General in charge of the Federal Department of Justice, just wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, saying that supervised injection is dangerous and sites offering the service shouldn't operate in the United States. He also threatened that local officials who participate and healthcare providers who staff such facilities should be subject to arrest. What is your reaction to this?
Well, I think we need to be clear that this was a threat that was veiled. It wasn't even veiled. This was a threat masquerading as an op-ed. So, first, I'm surprised that the New York Times even printed it because there were factual inaccuracies right in the actual piece. But this is clear that the federal government right now is doubling down on failed, drug war and criminalization approaches. They're not rooted in science, what they're trying to do. We try to really make it clear to people that there's no evidence that shows that increasing criminal penalties up to and including homicide, life in prison, that actually reduce drug-related crime or drug use. So number one, that stuff just doesn't work. Number two, people don't get better that way. It doesn't solve the actual problems we're trying to solve. So I think this is clear that they're doubling down on this. This is not about what works. This is about what they think, their base or whoever wants to hear. And so, part of the uphill battle we have around trying to address the overdose crisis is letting people know that locking people up doesn't work, no matter how many people you lock up. I mean, look at what the response was to crack during the Clinton crime bill and, mass incarceration of largely communities of color. You have this return right now, this pivoting towards charging people with homicide for providing drugs that somebody overdoses on and increasing penalties, on fentanyl and things like that. These things don't work. We know that they're going to disproportionately harm poor folks and communities of color, and is going to have no impact on drug use or overdose rates. So, I think we just need to be clear about what this is. This is political rhetoric. This is not about science or fact or any of that.
So, is New York anywhere near passing a bill like California did to okay supervised injection sites or safe consumption spaces?
There's been a bill that's been proposed. This will probably be the second year that's proposed by Linda Rosenthal, called the Safer Consumption Bill, and it would authorize sites to be able to do exactly this. There's also some discussion about doing these as a research pilot, which would be, it's not ideal. We believe that the science is out on this. It's been available from other countries for decades that these facilities work in doing what they say they're going to do and what we want them to do. So, you know, I mean, if we have to do it as a research pilot, so be it, so that we can prove that they work. But in the meantime, you know, we have a long history through needle exchange of the government warning people that if they were going to do it, that they would go to jail. And in many cases, those battles were fought out in court. So, you know, if the Justice Department is really trying to warn people that they're going to be charged with this, California, Washington, right, Philadelphia, other, you know, places have said that they're moving ahead with this. So mm-hmm. I think what we're going to see is a showdown between the federal government and local health and other officials to do this. And I would be reticent if I didn't just sort of say that in the harm reduction world, we lost a titan this last week. His name was Dan Bigg, and he was the founder of the Chicago Recovery Alliance. Mm-hmm. I bring this up to mention that Dan Bigg was providing naloxone to people before it was legal or sanctioned, so that people could reverse overdoses and mm-hmm. stay alive. So, you know, it's one example of, you know, public health people and activists saying, we know what the right thing to do is. This is going to save lives. So we're going to do it. And if we need to battle this out in court, then so be it.
Wow.
And so this is kind of a historical pattern where the public health people, where people who are actually dealing with people who are addicted to opioids and whatever, have been engaging kind of harm reduction approaches. Can you talk a little about the history of the harm reduction movement?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, harm reduction came out as a form of community self-defense, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you know, you can find out if you, you know, if you really talk to people is that especially communities of color have been doing harm reduction for decades, mm-hmm. Mainly for survival, right? Mm-hmm. So this is about the fact that, you know, the federal government, right, state governments, elected officials are doing their best to criminalize and otherwise harm people who use drugs. And I should mention that not usually, but in this country, you know, with the history of prohibition and the war on drugs, we don't criminalize drugs based on pharmacology, right? We criminalize drugs in this country based on who uses them and why. Mm-hmm. So you can go back to, you know, the opium legislation, right? And Chinese laborers, right? It was about panic. It was about racism. It was about xenophobia, right? And then you can move all the way up, right? Marijuana, right? Marijuana is called marijuana, so it sounds Mexican, right? Now you can go to the crack epidemic, right? And you have super predators and crack babies and all of this other rhetoric around this stuff. So meanwhile, you know, you can go to your doctor and get prescribed things that are just as harmful, if not more. And I can go to the corner store and buy alcohol, which kills more people a year than all the other drugs combined. So, you know, when we think about the history of harm reduction, right, this was people doing it for self-defense to save themselves, to save their own lives, to save their neighbors' lives. This is about people buying syringes by themselves and giving them to people out of the trunks of their car. This is about Dave Purchase in Tacoma, Washington, buying syringes on his own and setting up a card table and saying, people are dying of AIDS. You know, they're getting it transmitted from injection drug use. And so I'm just going to do this because it's the right thing to do. And so ultimately what you find is you find harm reductionists, activists, communities of color, right? Other people, you know, other groups that have been harmed and marginalized, right? Drug users themselves, saying we're going to save our own lives. And then typically what happens is the policy ends up following because public health folks get on board and say, wow, maybe there's something to this, right? And so then maybe there's research on it, and then there's advocacy with elected officials. I got to tell you, you know, it's exhausting from an activism, social justice standpoint. And I wish they would just realize that we were right then. We've always been right. We're right now. We're going to be right for the next thing. And so, you know, maybe we don't have to fight on this, and maybe that the elected officials and other folks can just listen to harm reductionists, activists, right? People who are directly impacted by this stuff, and do the right thing.
Hmm. Yeah. All right. So, I think that, we might be getting close to wrapping up. So I want to just ask, what can folks do to learn more about this?
Sure. Well, if anybody's interested, tomorrow is actually International Overdose Awareness Day. It's a day to memorialize and remember the people that we've lost to overdose. But more importantly, this year, we're also going to demand action. You know, at this point, 72,000 people died last year, right? Those are people's loved ones, friends, neighbors, community members. That impacts us all. So, you know, we need to demand action. So people can show up tomorrow at West Capitol Park, right outside of the state capitol at noon. We're going to have a memorial and a rally and a speak out there. People can go to check out the End Overdose New York Coalition, right? So that's endoverdoseny.org or hashtag End Overdose New York or End Overdose NY. People go to our website, thecatalcenter.org. So, you know, there's a lot of places people can get more information, but I really want to encourage people to take action at this point and really need to demand, you know, sensible policies rooted in public health and away from prohibition, away from criminalization, because we know it doesn't work. It harms our communities and people don't get better in jail and prison.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening, Keith.
Anytime.
Yeah. All right. So that was Keith Brown with the Catal Center for Health Equity and Justice, director of health and harm reduction at that place, talking about the overdose crisis in America and harm reduction responses to it.